Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Live from DW Studios in Bonn, Germany, this is Africa Link with me, Crispin Mwakideu. Our main stories this Tuesday, the 23rd of June. Ethiopia's ruling party is declared official winner of last month's election after clinching nearly all parliamentary seats. We look at the claims that the vote wasn't free and fair.
The opposition does have a bone to pick with the government, but it's mainly things that put obstacles in the path of the opposition on the way to elections rather than on election day.
And Cameroon's indomitable lionesses miss out on a chance to progress to the quarters of the FIFA Women's World Cup, but Cameroon's coach is looking to the future.
I'm satisfied. From the past days, I've been receiving many messages from Cameroon back home because they're interested. Some girls are interested in playing soccer.
These stories and more in this edition of Africa Link. Stay tuned.
Top story.
Clean sweep is what Ethiopia's ruling EPRDF party did after the electoral board announced the results of the elections held on May the 24th. The ruling party won 546 parliamentary seats, with the result of one remaining seat yet to be confirmed. However, the opposition has alleged that the government had used authoritarian tactics to guarantee victory. Colette Onjoy reports from Addis Ababa.
The National Electoral Board of Ethiopia confirmed that 58 political parties registered to participate in the polls. But according to the official results, the ruling People's Revolutionary Democratic Front won 546 out of 547 parliamentary seats. Ironically, the chairman of the electoral board, Merga Bekana, says that ruling party performed better in these elections.
The performance is good, but the competition is also very strong this time because the other parties have also scored. I'm talking about the winner. I'm not talking about the loser. The losers, the details will be given. It will be loaded in our website.
The electoral board says that the winner of the one remaining seat is yet to be confirmed. These results indicate that there has not been any change in parliament. The governing party had control of the same number of seats in the last parliament. For Sisei Wobushet, what's most important is that the elections were peaceful.
I'm excited because we're able to conduct such kind of peaceful election. And as Ethiopian, as a nation, I'm very proud of my country and my people.
Addis Ababa resident Elias Meseret says this sweeping victory for the incumbent party was something many Ethiopians expected.
I think it will be very strange even in African standards, but many people have already expected it, especially after last month, after the announcement of the preliminary results.
With the parliament now controlled by a 99.9% majority from the ruling party, the next prime minister of Ethiopia will obviously be selected by the party members according to the constitution. There are already speculations that the current Prime Minister, Hailemariam Desalegn, might continue with the premiership.
Koleta Wanjohi reporting from Addis Ababa. Critics of the Ethiopian government also say the elections were not free and fair because of a lack of freedom of speech in the country. To find out more about that assessment, Mark Caldwell has been speaking to Jason Mosley, Associate Fellow with the Africa Programme at Chatham House in the UK.
Well, the conduct of the polls themselves on polling day, I think, did proceed with very few incidents, considering that it's a country of around 90 million people. However, the landscape, the electoral landscape, is not open and competitive in an unrestricted way. So the opposition does have a bone to pick with the government, but it's mainly things that put obstacles in the path of the opposition on the way to elections rather than on election day.
Rights groups say the government uses anti-terrorism laws to silence dissent and jail its critics. Do you see any sign that the regime could become less repressive in future?
There's two factors that could govern that. One would be security situation in the region and the security situation in the country evolving in such a way that the government felt more comfortable with a more competitive electoral landscape. The other thing would be the emergence of more organized and wider base that could present a more coherent and widespread challenge to the ruling party across regions.
In spite of criticism of its rights record, US President Barack Obama is going to be visiting Ethiopia. What do you think the US president will be hoping to achieve?
Well, I think the region is fairly significant for the U.S. in terms of national security objectives. Its proximity to the Middle East and the presence of internationally linked militant organizations like Al-Shabaab in Somalia and increasingly in coastal Kenya mean that this region is an important security partner for the U.S. However, the visit to Addis Ababa is also quite significant in terms of visiting the African Union headquarters, which are based there. And it's, I think, been a tricky one for U.S. presidents in the past. We haven't had a sitting U.S. president visit the African Union headquarters. And given the influence of other important countries like China or India and other players in the near abroad with influence in the region, they'll be wanting in Washington to send a signal of strong U.S. support and interest and engagement with Africa as a region. So it's a two-prong visit, one being the signaling and the handling of the important partnership for the U.S. with Ethiopia, but it's also needs to communicate those concerns around the human rights environment with the bigger project around African Union.
Ethiopia's economic growth has been impressive of late. The government even claimed this was the reason for its success at the polls. How would you describe the state of the Ethiopian economy?
Ethiopian government is certainly overseeing some dramatic structural transformations to the economic landscape. These are mainly to do with improving baseline infrastructural capacity of the country. The supply of electricity has increased a lot. Telecommunications are improving. There's a lot that could be improved further there. Roads, the rail system should be, linking them to the sea again via Djibouti by early next year. Those things are important, but they don't necessarily quickly translate into tangible differences for lots and lots of people. Headline figures on poverty reduction are quite dramatic improvements, but whether that is felt by the large majority of the population in a way that would translate into an electoral result, given everything we've already said about the electoral environment, I'm not sure that that's a huge factor.
Jason Mosley from Chatham House in the UK.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Round the clock news. DW Television has launched a new 24-hour English language news channel on Monday. With it, Deutsche Welle hopes to improve its competitiveness and reach a bigger audience. The launch was timed to coincide with the opening of the Global Media Forum, an annual media congress also organized by Deutsche Welle. This report by Nicholas Martin has been adapted for Africa Link by Jen Ayeko.
The new DW, made for minds, starting June 22nd.
It's now time to report about developments from within DW. Monday, 22nd June, marks yet another step forward for DW as it launches its new English television channel. Editors, technicians and presenters have been working towards the start of the new channel. For DW's Director General Peter Lemburg, it's a mammoth but worthwhile project.
Well, English is the most spoken language in the world, and we already reach the most of our users in the English language. So it's kind of an important step for us to strengthen our English offer, which we already have. And I think that the demand for German issues, for German opinions, is quite rising. And so we think that it's a good step to go into the international market and to have a better offer with more news, more analysis, and more views how Germans think of the world. And so I think it's a good start on Monday, and we're quite sure that we will have a very convincing offer.
The new 24-hour English programming provides hourly up-to-date news broadcasts. Europe and North America play a key role, but DW wants to better establish itself and be more relevant in Africa and Asia. For this, DW has also expanded its network. It shall now have correspondents reporting from places like Bangkok, Lagos and Cairo.
We would like to surprise our viewers so often, be less conventional, less predictable and give the viewer a wow effect, whereby people say, I did not know that or I did not expect that, or they say, it was rewarding to check out DW.
Das hat sich wieder gelohnt, bei der DW reinzuschauen.
Kerstin von Namen, head of editorial department, speaking there. At the center of the new TV program is the new studio. For more than 2 months, technicians have been working on the new video wall. It consists of a high resolution, weighs more than 1 ton, it's 12 meters long and 2 meters high.
I think it provides a lot of opportunities to better explain issues. With the big screen, we can illustrate everything very well. With the help of that video wall, we can integrate all complex issues or topics that do not have videos, such as economics, when it comes to numbers or abstract topics. The presenter has more possibilities to interact with the pictures. That makes the news interesting and informative.
That is Ved Adam, DW editor, who has been part of the team working on the construction of the new English channel.
The new DW, made for minds, starting June 22nd.
For DW's Director General, Peter Lembo.
Oh, you get, obviously, the traditional strength of Deutsche Welle, which is serious, unbiased journalism for now over 60 years. But you always get more background information. We will not only show the world the typical news stories they can see everywhere. We try to have exclusive stories from the international scene, from our target markets in Asia and Africa, for instance. But we also want to show German perspectives. And I think we will always try to bring together the world of the internet and the world of the traditional news. So it will be, I think, a kind of special offer. And I think it will be an enrichment of the general markets for international TV channels.
From June 22nd, DWTV continues to broadcast in 4 languages. In addition to the new English channel, there are programs in German, in Spanish for Latin America, and the Arabic for all viewers ranging from Oman to Morocco. Here too, viewers can look forward to some exciting innovations.
Jen Ayeko with that report by Nicholas Martin.
Africa on the move.
And in this week's Africa on the Move, we look at the progress that has been made in helping women who suffer from obstetric fistula. This is a condition in which patients lose control of the flow of urine and feces from their bodies. A Scottish charity, the Freedom from Fistula Foundation, has set up 3 treatment centres in Africa, one in Sierra Leone, another in Malawi, and a third in Kenya, from where James Shimanyula now reports.
Obstetric fistula has been a major challenge for many women in Kenya. It occurs when a woman endures several days of prolonged and obstructed labor after the baby's head pushes against her pelvic bone during contraction, preventing the flow of blood and automatically causing tissues to die. According to medical experts, once the tissues die, a tiny hole is formed through which urine or stool leak. 19-year-old Elizabeth Katenge remembers the 10 agonizing hours of labor from her enclosed hospital bed.
One leg of the child I was delivering protruded from the birth canal. The doctors pushed the child's leg, put it into proper position in the womb and pulled it out. I felt a lot of pain. I thought that what had happened was one of the pangs of birth or agony that women undergo during birth. This was the first time that I was delivering a child. Smelling urine was the order of the day. No matter how many times I washed myself, the smell remained permanent.
Margaret Wanjiru, director of the Nairobi branch of the Freedom from Fistula Foundation, which sponsors fistula operations in Kenya, expounded on the foundation's vision.
We are proud that we have managed to be part of the process of assisting women regain their dignity. Our vision is to eradicate fistula. Looking ahead, we envision a time when Africa will be clear of fistula because it has happened in other continents.
The Freedom for Fistula Foundation has its main center at the Kenyatta National Hospital in the capital, Nairobi. The hospital's chief executive officer, Lily Koros, reflects on the year that the center opened its doors for the first time to fistula patients.
Since 2006, The medical camps have enabled 4,000 women from poor backgrounds to access fistula treatment free of charge, thereby completely transforming their lives by restoring their dignity.
Kenya has only 3 internationally recognized doctors specializing in fistula repair. One of them, Dr. Weston Kisa, recollects the days when women had to wait for fistula repair.
As we started, there was a long waiting period for our women to access service. But today we have no waiting list. The patients come, they are admitted, operated, and they go home.
Kenya is winning the battle against the fistula with the preventive measures such as improved pre- and postnatal care. Statistics from United Nations Population Fund and Kenya's Ministry of Health estimate that nearly 1,000 fistula cases were recorded in 2013 and 2014 as opposed to 7,000 in 2012.
James Shimanyula reporting from Nairobi. A damning UN report published earlier this month claimed that there is no rule of law in Eritrea. Rather, the Horn of Africa nation is ruled by fear. It also said human rights abuses were driving some 5,000 Eritreans to flee the country every month. Today, the Commission of Inquiry's report on Eritrea is going to be submitted to the regular session of UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. Barbara Lochbihler is a German member of the European Parliament and vice chair of its subcommittee on human rights. She's been telling Mark Caldwell what the EU should be doing to improve human rights conditions in Eritrea.
Well, already in March we had a debate in our human rights subcommittee, and it is quite difficult to influence the Eritrean government to change its policy. And there I think we have to think about possibilities how we can do this. But since they had independence in 1991, there is really no political parties are there, there is no independent media, there have not been any elections, and as in this UN inquiry report it is said brilliantly, the country is run not by law that rules Eritrea but by fear. So this is very widespread.
Are those Eritrean refugees who arrive in Europe, are they getting the asylum to which they are entitled?
Not always, but to my understanding, at least from my country, they are not being sent back. But we know in many individual cases, they are very poor. They spend money and take the little money they have and escape through very dangerous routes through the desert and also staying then perhaps in other war-torn neighboring countries.
The European Union finances development programs in Eritrea, which it enacts together with the Eritrean government. Do you think those programs ought to be stopped or at least reviewed?
I think we should review them, and we should clearly say if we want to continue, then the human rights situation has to change. I mean, the UN inquiry report also says that some of the human rights violations they have documented may constitute crimes against humanity. This is not a term you use easily. So all things together, disappearances, killings, this permanent surveillance, no freedom of movement, and all this abusive military and national service, all this together, these are very severe human rights violations. And I think the European Union should not continue with their development aid as it is. They have to make it a special effort to influence the Eritrean government and perhaps demand that what is on the paper, that they have an 18-month military service, will then de facto definitely be implemented.
But do you think the Eritrean government will be susceptible to that sort of pressure?
Well, it's very difficult. What we heard is that nearly no foreign government has influence there, but we have to give it a try. And also, I think Eritrea is part of other consultation forums like the Khartoum process, where the European Union and member states are discussing also with Eritrean government to fight the spread of trafficking in people, but also fighting terrorism. And in all those occasions where we have a possibility of direct dialogue with them, we should let the Eritrean governments know.
Barbara Lochbihler, Vice Chair of the Subcommittee on Human Rights at the European Parliament.
Making a difference.
Bruised but brave lionesses. Cameroon's indomitable lionesses were the only African nation to make it through to the round of 16 at the FIFA Women's World Cup in Canada. They didn't get through to the quarterfinals after losing 1-0 to China. But even to have made it through to the knockout stage is considered a remarkable achievement, as this was their first ever Women's World Cup. Moki Kinzeka introduces us to the man behind the team. Go,
Cameroonian fans celebrate the performance of the national team on Sunday at the Women's Football World Cup in Canada. The Indomitable Lionesses is the only African team to make it to the knockout stages at this year's tournament. Victorine Formum, a local coach, says the man behind this success is Coach Enongacho.
Female football before today was like taboo. People who played it were all downgraded, outcasts, dropouts, and things like that. And nobody had time for them. And you, as national coach, had to like go into the nooks and crannies looking for the players to make a difference in the squad, and struggling with little or no motivation to build up a team. So there were times that he had to pay his personal money for these players to go for training and give them training allowances.
Victorine is a close friend of Enongacho, who is currently with the team in Canada. She studied with him at Cameroon's Institute of Youth and Sports. Eno, according to Victorine, developed love for female football 20 years ago.
Eno, right from school, has been this kind of man that has always wanted to make a difference. He's always strived for excellence. Eno is this man that started with humble beginnings, and today everybody's talking about Enongacho. If he were not humble, he would not be having all of these praises too.
Among the talents Enongacho detected is midfielder Ngonomani. She says she and her teammates rose to world football glory thanks to their coach. The Indomitable Lionesses lost 1-0 to China in their last game, but Ngono thinks Coach Eno did a good job.
Even though China won us, I want to say I'm very happy. I want to say congratulations to Eno, to the coach.
The coach of the Lionesses has gained the confidence of millions of Cameroonian fans, including Linus Phobi.
Cameroonians are doing exceptionally well. If they maintain the same coach, I'm very optimistic that the next time Cameroon is going to make it very far. Maintain the same coach and watch out corruption.
Professor Joseph Owona, president of the FIFA Normalization Committee of Cameroon's football, sees good signs in Enongacho's team.
Cette équipe, il faut la louer par son patriotisme.
This Enongacho team has shown proof of patriotism and courage. Let's totally support and encourage them. If they have support and continue being loyal and faithful, they shall go places.
Je pense que c'est une équipe sur laquelle on peut compter.
Coach Enongacho is now 50 years old, but does he still have big dreams for the team?
Yes, of course. As a coach, you must have a dream. You must have objectives. And I think my dream came true. And it is through hard work, through discipline, and a lot of sacrifice.
In the last 10 years, Coach Eno has won the gold medal in female football in the All-Africa Games and is the man who carried the Lionesses to where it is today. He says his plan now is to prepare the girls for the women's tournament of the African Cup of Nations that Cameroon will be hosting in 2016.
I'm satisfied. From the past days, I've been receiving many messages from Cameroonia back home because they're interested. They're interested. Some girls are interested in playing soccer. So I think we'll go back home. We'll try to reorganize some campaign for those willing to join the national team.
That report was compiled by Moki Kinzeka in Yaounde. Our main stories before we leave you. In Ethiopia, the elections held last month have ended in a sweeping victory for the ruling party. We've also been hearing about human rights abuses in Eritrea and a new 24-hour television news channel launched by Deutsche Welle. We welcome your comments on this program. Just send us an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110 Bonn, Germany, or an SMS to country code 49160 957 0800-795-5910. For more news on the continent, visit dw.com/Africa. Let's meet tomorrow, same time. From me, Crispin Mwakideu. Take care.